What's up, Dune fans? Welcome back to the Dune Not Enter podcast, where today the starter car pay a greater price than spice. I'm your host, Humphrey Hsu, and joining me are my friends and co-hosts, Fillmore John.
What's up, guys?
And Nolan Zhang.
Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back, everyone, and today we will be covering the second half of Chapter 43 of Dune, and this is Episode 57. Yes, I checked my notes this time. So, yeah, I mean, more brilliant stuff going on in this chapter. Really exciting stuff, but anything exciting going on in y'all's lives that you want the listeners to know about?
My church today, my youth director asked me to bring like all the guitars in my house. And I don't know why, but she made us all practice guitar for like the first hour and a half of church today. So weird.
Oh, so basically a battle set.
You're learning, I guess, the battle set.
I didn't know you played the guitar.
I do, yeah. Not that much anymore, but I think I might get back into it once I have more time in the summer.
Something you plan to pick up in college, or?
I don't know. It's a lot of time investment, and I honestly got to see my college schedule. And as an engineer, I don't know about that.
True, yeah.
Well, 12 hours in the library every day.
No promises.
Cool. Yeah, well, let's dive right into the chapter then. But before we do that, let's do our quotes. So, Fillmore, as usual, you have the first quote.
Okay, so for my quote this week, I chose, "If I do," Paul said, "I shall stand there without weapon and let you slay me."
Ooh, how dramatic. Mm-hmm. My quote goes,
I wonder who he could be talking to.
Yeah. My quote goes, "When you're through, be certain you haven't discovered everything."
Oh, yeah, so blind, I guess.
A little something to keep in mind, yeah.
Yep.
So my quote this week goes, "The people who can destroy a thing, they control it."
Yeah, it's one of those like paradoxes almost, because it's not really a paradox, but it feels like one of those paradoxical statements. So really interesting. Yeah, cool quotes. Cool. So Fillmore, why don't you take it away with the first section?
Okay, so as we pick up from where we left off from the last chapter, Gurney is discussing the untrustworthy people from among the smugglers who he suspects to be Sardaukar in disguise.
Yeah, I really just like how Gurney hesitates when he finds himself talking about these people. He calls them off-worlders. There's kind of a bit of contempt in it almost. It really shows how, like, despite Gurney having tried to hold on to his, like, Atreides roots and his, like, civilized, like, manner and, like, his off-world status almost, it's almost, like, it is undeniable that in the years that he spent on Arrakis has definitely left a lasting mark on Gurney.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a harsh environment. It just really contrasts a lot from the speech of Gurney that we saw back on Caladan.
I think he was also surprised by himself, which is like, whoa.
Yeah.
It's nice to see.
He's like, I'm becoming part of the desert now.
Desert power.
Especially after he was like criticizing Paul for like saying we and inclusive language when referring to the Fremen. I think he surprised himself there too. Also, like, let's just talk a bit about the cave that the Fremen have hidden here. Because remember, like, how Gurney's like, wow, this is a great place for a base. And then it turns out there is a Fremen base, so it's not crazy after all. To me, it's just like, it's strange to me that the cave itself is called the Cave of Birds. And I don't know, I don't feel like there's a lot of birds on Arrakis, especially since there's little water. But to me, like, the significance of naming it like the Cave of Birds, I kind of suspect it's almost like an advanced operating area have, because from like early on in the book when we saw that they could like fly the spice production like ornithopters and stuff after like they took control of the spice factory, right? We
right.
do suspect that the Fremen probably know how to fly and probably have some practice crafts so that they know how to like practice and get good at it. So like, I don't know, I highly suspect this is like an airbase of some type. And like, how else would they like go all across the galaxy, you know, like conquer the galaxy without knowing how to fly? Like, they gotta learn how to get off the ground somewhere.
Aerodynamic.
I also think it's quite an interesting name as well, because the only birds we've seen so far are birds like hawks or eagles, and I wouldn't say that they're a common sight either. And as for your theory about it being an airbase, I think it makes a decent amount of sense, because they're going to need some air power in order to go against the Harkonnen, so I can see why they would set up a base like this. Although, I don't think it's very clear as to what type of aerial weapons the Fremen have, because, we know they can use ornithopters and such, but I feel like they might have other things, maybe like ornajets or something along those lines.
Yeah, better, something better than, you know, helicopter-style things.
Right.
at the very least, they at least have anti-air defense in the missiles, you know. So
yeah, they have those RPGs.
Okay, also another big reveal of this chapter, not for us readers to be honest, but mostly for Gurney Halleck. Remember, Gurney and Halleck and Paul have reunited at this point. So Paul is actually finally revealed to Gurney Halleck as being associated with the name Muad'Dib. And for Gurney, it's a lot to take in because he's heard so much about this Muad'Dib and how monstrous he is, you know, out in the desert with drum heads made out of the skin of a Harkonnen officer and with his like squad of jaded death commandos. Like, this Muad'Dib that he's heard is totally different from who he expected Paul to be.
Right. Honestly, I would also be in a massive shock if I heard all these horrible rumors about someone so close to me. And of course, we know that these are baseless rumors, as Paul would never do something like this. However, I think correlating Paul with the Muad'Dib must have had like the same effect as finding out your neighbor was secretly a serial killer. Very shocking.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel that his name is Muad'Dib is just blown out of proportions here. So I'll just read the little chunk that you quoted. And this is the part that really arouses Gurney's suspicions. So it goes, quote, Gurney recalled the stories told of Muad'Dib that Lee Sanal gave, how he had taken the skin off a Harkonnen officer to make his drumheads, how he was surrounded by death commandos, Fatakin, who leaped into battle, excuse me, with their death chants on their lips. So Paul's almost like an evil name at this point. Not Paul, of course, you know, Muad'Dib. Or Paul Muad'Dib, I guess. He's like a cult leader in the eyes of the smugglers and the outsiders. So everything really just continues to hint at the jihad. And Paul's perspective hasn't really revealed this, especially because there was a time skip and also it's kind of gradual from his perspective. But, you know, maybe things are worse than we thought. And this whole jihad thing has progressed further than we could have imagined. Maybe Paul can't really tell. And since we're viewing it through Paul's eyes, we can't really tell. But the outworlders can tell that the Fremen are these fanatical creatures rallying behind Paul, maybe. It's probably more clear to someone that's not in the eyes of the Fremen.
Right.
I think the only like justifiable like means that Paul has at this point to justify that he's not the same fanatical jihad is the fact that like it was mentioned later on in this chapter that like whatever his men does is remembered as like in the legends, at least like they're remembered as what Muad'Dib had done himself. So like maybe these things did happen, but maybe it wasn't necessarily Paul who did them. Maybe it's just another Fatakin or something, and it just got tied to Paul because, you know, it's like a cool thing to the Fremen, you know, it's like chopping off heads, you know, killing 20 people. Like, come on, guys.
Right. And they also mentioned, I think maybe in an earlier chapter and this chapter as well, that they tend to blow things way out of proportion. And in this case of how he makes it, how he skins people into like the drum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just not, it just doesn't seem like Paul.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't quite believe it yet, but we got to read more, really see where he's gone. Like, we got to see more from Gurney's point of view, honestly.
Yeah, it presents something fresh, like, yeah.
After all, like, both Gurney and Paul, they've lived, like, two very different lives after they've been separated by the Harkonnen attack in Arrakis. Like, Gurney, like, he's right now, like, facing Paul, hearing all these different things. He's kind of conflicted between falling totally back into line behind Paul as, like, a Atreides retainer, or whether he should like hold on to his current allegiance to the friends that he has made among the smugglers. Because while at least to Paul, he doesn't seem like much because he's just another smuggler. Among the smugglers themselves, Gurney has made a name for himself. And he's already always had a name because he's Gurney Halleck, like a crazy like fighter. But like right now, Gurney gets a free pass with the Fremen because he's Paul's friend. Secondly, because he's Gurney Halleck, everyone's heard of him. But the truth is, the other smugglers with him don't hold the same status and luxury of like being friends with Paul, you know? And at this point, it's honestly up to Gurney to speak up for them, or else they'll probably find themselves disposed of in the deep desert because they saw things that they weren't supposed to see, like the warm riding, and like they're probably not going to make it back alive.
Right? Yeah, so it's really this two-pronged responsibility. So somehow Gurney has to convince the Fremen that these are good men. You know, well, clearly Gurney thinks that some of these are good men based off his words, but he has to convince the Fremen of that, and that's not as easy. Because Paul can't really attest to those men as Paul attested for Gurney, right? So it's just going to be kind of a fight for him to keep those people he's become loyal to alive.
Right. And talking about good men, I hope Tuik wasn't killed during the crossfire.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I don't even know if Tuik was here.
Where is Tuik?
Yeah, where is Tuik? He disappeared again. He's only showed up like 3 times. Yeah.
Yeah. He's probably at the smuggler base.
Yeah. So I also think Gurney might just be misreading everything here a little bit. In my opinion, he misreads a lot of stuff in this chapter. And he's just picking up, you know, because these guys in the Arrakis world, they're so good at listening. He picks up on some hard undertones in Stilgar's speech that might hint at something bigger, right? And isn't Stilgar just speaking in hard undertones because he's awaiting Paul's inevitable challenge? That's what I would, you know, if I knew my death was coming, I wouldn't be speaking very softly and nicely or something. You know, I would be a little bit miffed, right? Or maybe Stilgar's just jealous of Gurney, not because of their friendship, but because he'll survive, you know, this whole thing while Stilgar won't, because Stilgar is kind of, for tradition, has to challenge Paul, or sorry, Paul has to challenge Stilgar. But Gurney has no reason to do that because he's not really integrated into the Fremen, right? So so Gurney will definitely survive, but Stilgar may not, and Stilgar might be jealous of that. I mean, I definitely don't think it's their friendship that Stilgar is jealous of per se, but Nolan, I think you have some stuff to say about that.
Well, actually, like, before we go on to that, I just extending on what you just said, I just had this really weird thought that I think Stilgar, like, at least at the end of the chapter, it was mentioned by Paul himself that Stilgar is like a right hand, right?
Yeah.
But from Stilgar's perspective, when Gurney came back into the picture, who had originally served as like the Atreides' right hand, you know, as like Leto's right hand, everything. I think he saw himself being replaced by Gurney here, honestly. Like, he's like, oh no, he's back. And like you said, you know, like, he doesn't have to fight because he's not part of Fremen culture. It's not expected of him to die for Paul to take power. He was just like, shoot, I'm going to die. I'm going to get replaced by Gurney. And it's just like, there goes everything, you know? It's like, oh well. Like,
oh, so you think it has to do more with the relationship between them than, let's say, like, just his challenge of Stilgar?
Yeah, like the relationship, the expectations the Fremen have of him, and like Paul's defense of him, no matter what, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, he's gonna make it through alive. Stilgar just got the unlucky end of the stick because he's part of Fremen culture, and like, you know, he gotta die, you know, sometime, because every Fremen thinks that.
Well, I think that's a part of it, but like, in my personal opinion, I think he's just miffed because Paul is gonna challenge him, because since last episode, we know Stilgar is really uncertain about Paul's true motive, because all the Fremen want Paul to call out Stilgar. And we find the resolution to that at the rest of this episode, which is good. But I personally think it's just because he's expecting the challenge. And now that Gurney's here, there's another person to replace his spot. And it's just like sort of like moving toward his death a bit more.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's definitely understandable that Stilgar is on edge. But now we actually see Paul actually trying to make Stilgar and Gurney become friends, even though we clearly see that Stilgar is definitely much more upset than, you know, Paul is. So I'm going to read this portion to y'all because I thought I enjoyed it a lot. So it goes, "You are two I'd have be friends," Paul said. "Stilgar, the Fremen, is a name of renown," Gurney said. "Any killer Harkonnens I'd feel honored to count among my friends." "Will you touch hands with my friend, Gurney?" Paul asked. Slowly, Stilgar extended his hand, gripped the heavy calluses of Gurney's sword hand. "There are few who haven't heard of the name of Gurney Halleck." So it's just like, I find it comical almost. So like, Paul's just like, "It'd be nice if y'all could get along, you know?" And it's like, you know, "You've heard of Stilgar, right?" And then Gurney's like, "Of course I've heard of Stilgar. You know, like, who hasn't?"
It's such an awkward interaction.
Yeah,
it's so funny. It's like trying to introduce, like, two different friend groups, you know, like, together. Like, it doesn't always work out well.
Yeah.
Especially if they've never met each other before and, like, very little in common. It is awkward for both parties. But it's also kind of nerve-wracking for the person who's introducing both parties, kind of like Paul here, because they have to be careful how much attention they balance and give each friend, because, you know, like, you don't want to, like, seem like you're neglecting one over the other or favoring one over the other.
Right, you don't want to play favorites. It's honestly really awkward meeting someone your friend knows in the beginning, because, well, you don't really know them and you want to be friendly to them, but it's really difficult sometimes because you don't know their personality. And
right,
most of the time it does work out because friendships are usually created through common interests. And I think it'll work out this time as well because their common interest is Paul. And they're very loyal to them.
Yeah, that's a pretty big common interest.
Right.
Very plot-centric.
Also, just as Paul was ready to, you know, go back, go sit in this cave and have this nice long talk, resolve all these different problems, and have finally Gurney and, you know, Stilgar maybe become friends, you know, maybe even ask Gurney to place Balisette a little for Stilgar, they're suddenly interrupted by an alarm symbol. And I find it pretty amusing almost as a physical percussion instrument that they use as their alarm, because I don't know, but I kind of expected it to be like a call, like one of the other hunter calls that the Fremen have, or I don't even know, just like the typical alarm siren going off underground because they're like in an underground cavern, it's kind of like right. Fallout shelter or something. But like, I don't know, like it's just nice to see that there's like another instance of traditional system being used to contrast like the super advanced modern like space traveling technology that we see to like use to raise the alarm. I think it's just cute.
Yeah, honestly, I wasn't really expecting a symbol considering the vibrations it causes, and I don't know if it's strong enough to cause a worm to show up, but I guess it's better to be safe than sorry, you know? Mm-hmm. And uh-huh. I know that in the earlier days of human civilization, they used like massive bells or gongs to signal an emergency. So this may be where the alarm originated from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I suppose they only used in safe situations like caves where maybe, you know, the rock will absorb the vibration somehow, or, you know, before it disperses mm-hmm. towards the worms. Because I know out in the open they used those calls, right? When they were mm-hmm. writing the worm or whatever, they were using those calls, but they're just using symbols here. So
yeah, I definitely kind of see what y'all are like me. We won't ever probably like, ever really know why they use the symbols, but it was just nice to see.
Yeah,
right.
Also, another thing that I noticed that like, well, I know we've all been laughing about, you know, how overpowered Paul and the Fremen are becoming. In this alarming scene that we encounter right now, we do get a reminder on like the fact that even though they are powerful, Paul and the Fremen aren't untouchable. So the alarming scene was that there's a bunch of Sardaukar hidden among the smugglers, which was kind of suspected in the beginning, but now they've revealed themselves and are actually now trying to fight against the Fremen and Paul. So the truth is, the Sardaukar aren't as talented as the Fremen. I think we already know that. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we still need to remember that while they aren't more talented, they're still quite renowned fanatic warriors themselves who pack a pretty mean punch. So even though they're being slowly put down one by one, there's still like quote-unquote bloody rag mounts of Sardaukar and Fremen across the chamber. So they're doing damage, you know, like they're doing some bits, you know, like they're doing some bits of harm towards the Fremen.
Yeah, I mean, of course, if the Fremen were completely infallible, there would honestly be no story because of how strong they are. And however, we already know that if there are going to be dead Fremen, there's going to be at least twice as many dead Sardaukar. I think it's mentioned later in the chapter, 2 Fremen for 7 dead Sardaukar.
Yeah. Paul had to pull up the body count. I remember Paul did point it out in this chapter. He was just counting it off to the Sardaukar commander. He's like, by the way, we did win that encounter, by the way. And like, you have no chance anyway. So it's just like smack talking to commander. It was really funny.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty funny. But I mean, somehow Paul has a claim to the dukedom, even though he's in the middle of nowhere, Arrakis here. Yeah. There's really nothing to... I don't even know if he's wearing the ducal signet ring right now. And
probably not.
Yeah, I mean, that would just make him a target, honestly. And somehow, you know, I thought that the Emperor had overthrown the Atreides and placed the Harkonnens as rulers in Arrakis. I'm not sure if that's correct, but, you know, but because the Emperor supported the Harkonnens with so many Sardaukar. I thought that the Emperor was in on the whole thing, right? But I guess that's not true. And so,
it's been,
you know,
years too.
Yeah. So in that case, I didn't realize that the Atreides still had a claim to this land. I thought it was taken away by the Harkonnens, or maybe mm-hmm. Paul just has outdated information. Who knows? But since the Sardaukar are, you know, believing that, then possibly it's not outdated. But no matter what, the Sardaukar at least stopped fighting, and they at least somewhat listened to him.
I think the Harkonnens weren't given back the land formally, and it is still under the Atreides, except it's taken by the Harkonnens, so it's sort of illegal in a way, but I think the Emperor's just turning a blind eye just because he was in on the plot by quite a bit, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's just my theory.
Yeah.
So I just really like the speaking Sardaukar with Paul. Like, he's got a bit of a bite, to be honest. Even when he's obviously losing, he's snarky. He's challenging every single one of Paul's claims. He's like, he reminds me of like a true debater. He makes Paul justify every single one of his claims. Like, why he thinks they're Sardaukar in the first place, and why he thinks that he is the ruling Duke of Arrakis. Of course, like, Paul is Paul, and he's quick-witted himself. The answers come pretty naturally to him as well, and they're pretty good answers, honestly. They shut down all room for debate, but at the same time, it was still a really good attempt from the Sardaukar, and I just want to respect that from the commander.
Yeah, I also really like the description of him, which is, Paul studied the man, tall, flat-featured, with a pale scar across half his left cheek. Anger and confusion were betrayed in his manner, but still there was that pride about him without which a Sardaukar appeared undressed, and with which he could appear fully clothed, though naked. So even though he's in such a humiliating situation, he still retains his pride, and that is very respectable.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, it really just fits into all of those stereotypes that we have of the Sardaukar, you know, extremely prideful, subservient to only one person, and really all these ruthless fighters, right, who don't really bow to anyone. So,
right.
Yeah, so it's just, it keeps building up these images of Sardaukar in my mind that, yeah.
Absolutely terrifying. Mm-hmm. And yep. The thing is, like, Paul understands the Sardaukar. I'm not sure how much he's worked with them before, but, like, he understands them so well that he assumes some things about the Sardaukar, like the entire Sardaukar plan, honestly, like how they got the smugglers into the deep desert in the first place. And he's just so on point. He correctly deduced the fact that the Sardaukar are the ones to push the smugglers to become greedier and greedier in their spice gathering missions to venture into the deep desert where the Fremen roam. And that means hopefully they get captured and get brought closer to Paul. I don't know. It's a massive plan, but Paul deduced it. And it's so on point that Gurney audibly gasped behind Paul. It seems that, like, though Jessica isn't around to train Paul anymore, he's still got really impressive analysis skills and could definitely hold, like, a really strong, like, he could stare down any opponent.
Yeah. I really like the part where Paul smiled after Gurney gasped from his deduction, because I thought it was strangely comedic in such a tense moment. And I honestly love how this book manages to balance out the tenseness with some humorous elements. It makes for a much more enjoyable read.
Yeah, and it's just really surprising that the smugglers didn't see all of this coming, because I would have thought that at least Gurney would have found that these were Sardaukar long ago, right? But I suppose they're good at staying undercover. It's just crazy that even the Emperor is trying to infiltrate Fremen sieges. Like, everyone's trying to get in on it, you know? Everyone wants to know the secrets. The Fremen must now be universe famous that word of them have even got to the Emperor, who, you know, as we know, doesn't really concern himself with trivial things.
Right.
Right.
Well, anyways, it looks like Paul has gotten a lot better at using the voice, though, because we see him using it on the starter card to get his name, which is Captain Aramsham. Mm-hmm. And I guess it doesn't really explicitly state that Paul is using it at first, but later it is confirmed in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, he calls up the Saladay's voice here, and I just really wonder how there's any way to counter the voice. We've never really thought about that, because everything should have a counter, right? Maybe it's possible to train your personality to become so unpredictable that the voice can't, you know, penetrate your defenses, I guess, since the voice relies on an understanding of the subject you're trying to command. But that's, you know, has its own pitfalls, because if you're so unpredictable and you don't have any set patterns, then, you know, it's just kind of bad for your daily day-to-day life, right?
And, right.
Especially if you're fighting. You know, if you don't have at least some structure, it's not going to go very well.
Makes you hard to work with.
Yeah. Oh, definitely hard to work with. And also maybe, you know, limiting the specific frequency of the sound that you can hear, since, like, it's like a pitch and frequency required, or maybe like changing the delta frequency somehow. And just, you know, so that, like, because there's like a lot of different inflections and stuff in the voice. But again, that's probably detrimental. You won't be able to hear everything very clearly, right? So I don't know. I can't think of anything else. At least, you know, from my few minutes of thinking about it, maybe there's something that I'm missing that's really obvious to counter the voice.
Well, I think part
being
of
deaf
reason
was one of them.
Oh,
well,
wow.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, that's to be deaf.
And that's quite the detriment. Very obviously.
I think another reason why the voice is so strong is partly because not many people know of his existence in the first place, because Well, we assume that a lot of people knew about it. The starter card themselves, when he first got commanded by Paul and then when he actually responded, was surprised at what had happened. So I suspect that even the starter card, even the Imperium, doesn't know the true extent of the voice and how powerful it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, he seemed very confused when he gave away his name.
Yeah, because like if you had experienced it before, I feel like he wouldn't be that like that amazed by it. Especially, I expect the Emperor to have Bene Gesserit, but I guess he doesn't specifically train all the Sardaukar in the way of the voice, partly because I'm sure there's some type of code in the Bene Gesserit, like teaching somewhere against exposing too much knowledge about like what
their
the
power,
just like the capabilities.
Yeah. Because we know the Emperor is surrounded by Bene Gesserit, you know, even Princess Irulan and all the other people, they're all Bene Gesserit, right? Even the Reverend Mother and all that. So, I mean, it makes sense that they wouldn't teach it out, but I mean, I just feel like someone would have found out and devised a counter for it, right? And we know, you know, the first time you experience the voice, it's kind of a shock because we've witnessed it with Thufir Hawat. When he was commanded, it just, you know, kind of slipped out of his tongue or he just sat down, right? Just, you know, there's nothing really he could do about it because there was just that degree of control that Jessica had over him. And same with Paul here. It's not quite as strong, but enough to mostly control the Sardaukar. So it is, you know, even for a battle hardened Sardaukar, it's still, you know, something that will catch him off guard. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the few things that he couldn't control about the situation here.
It's just really interesting because it's just showing that these people have more in common than we think. All of these people, you know, ranging from the Sardaukar to the Fremen to the Mentats to the Bene Gesserit, because think about it, you know, the voice relies on an intimate understanding of people, and to understand people, you know, without having ever known them, it must fit into some archetype of humans that is trained into the Bene Gesserit. You know, the fact that Paul was able to command this Sardaukar without ever having met him before just shows that somehow he understands a bit of their inner workings, even though he's never, you know, one-on-one talk to this Captain or Ramsham. Yeah.
Right.
And I think the surprise of the Sardaukar host actually got another Sardaukar to do some pretty spicy action towards Paul himself. So here we actually get some personal action against Paul. So the Sardaukar, even though they're on the verge of defeat, haven't given up on the original mission to kill Paul. Yet, surprisingly, it isn't Paul or even a Fadakin who stops the Sardaukar who jumped at him with a knife. It's actually Captain Ramsham himself that stopped the other Sardaukar. And why is this, though? Like, why did like his fellow, like this captain, kill his own men, right? Like, I think it was at the point that like, he decided that angering the Fremen to the point of execution would be worse than submitting to Paul for a later chance to escape and hopefully report back to the Emperor the crucial new discovery that the Atreides line still lives on. But not only like lives on, he's at the head of the fierce Fremen race that's been cutting spice production for the Harkonnens for years. I think like that's more important to the commander, and he's willing to do what it takes to get back alive, I guess.
Right, like what use is getting killed out here when they have the chance to expose one of the biggest secrets of Arrakis? And if they get out the news that Paul Atreides is not dead, then they might even be rewarded instead of killed by the Emperor or maybe the Baron when they return with news of their failure.
Yeah, the craziest I feel like... go ahead.
The craziest part is just that, like, even though he thinks all this, like, Paul is just like, I'm not going to let this happen anyway. Since like, you're still my subject, so you're still prisoner. My prisoner.
Yeah, I mean, this captain has already correctly deduced that he's a dead man anyway, so might as well try to play their game and force their hand and see what happens, right? I mean, in the worst case, he's just dead anyway, so nothing worse can happen, right? So, I mean, it's nice to, even though the Sardaukar are the enemies, it's kind of interesting to see their strategies. Yeah, but I mean, Paul's plan for that, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so actually Paul's adding another complicated layer on top of the already like intense political situation going on here. Paul makes his five-head move, claiming that he in fact wants the Sardaukar to escape. He's like, let them go, actually. He's like, it's kind of reminds me of when the Mongols used to do like where they would wipe out like entire cities and just leave like a single person alive and let the people run off to the neighboring towns and bring the message that, you know, the Mongols are very furious at people for resisting their conquering, and hopefully the other towns will balance the mission. So this is like that same trick being used by Paul here. So the true question isn't whether it's going to succeed or not, because Paul will let them out. The trick is the Paul can't let these Sardaukar think they're leaving for free, you know? So he has to make it hard for these Sardaukar to escape. So set up this elaborate, like, I guess, farce for them. So they don't realize that, like, they're going to, like, ruin some devious plan that he has in wait for the Imperium. I don't know what he has in the works for the Imperium, but he's definitely planning something bigger, and they're just going to be the vessels to deliver the message.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But in my opinion, I think this is such a risky move, because I guess Paul thinks they're already ready to take on the Imperium for him to devise a move like this. But what's keeping the Sardaukar from coming back to assassinate him again? And next time they'll send even more people, and the next time even more people. So
yeah, I mean, they could have been overwhelmed here if they had, you know, more Sardaukar, if the Sardaukar knew that, you know, Paul was here. And just, I mean, it was just lucky that the Sardaukar were these Sardaukar were the ones that were ambushed by the Fremen, right?
And they were caught off guard.
Yeah, they wanted to come assassinate Paul. But I mean, the message, I don't know if this is some grand reveal for Paul, you know, just like, oh, I'm here, come and get me, kind of bring the war to him, right? But I mean, no matter how strong the Fremen is, I feel like they won't really be able to beat the military might of the Harkonnens, because it's just—it's not even that the Harkonnens are good fighters; it's just they just have so much resources compared to the Fremen. I mean, all the Fremen have is spice, and of course they have themselves. But without all of the advanced military technology, it's going to be an uphill battle.
Especially when the Imperium gets brought into play alongside the Harkonnens.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not exactly sure where the Empire's allegiances lie right now, because clearly he was mad after, you know, the way the Harkonnens deposed of Duke Leto. He was kind of pretty mad at that. So I don't know if the Emperor's still siding with the Harkonnens or if he's neutral now. But I mean, clearly since there's Sardaukar here, I mean, the Emperor has some say in this.
Right, I mean, who knows? He might even be happy that Paul's still alive, considering the treatment of Duke Leto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, the only evidence that we have against something like that is that, you know, clearly the Emperor's been sending scouts into Arrakis as Harkonnens to kind of report back and see what happens. And clearly the Sardaukar have also been instructed to kill Paul, given that that knife, you know, was flying at him. Right, so you know, it doesn't really look good in terms
support
of their,
for Paul.
Yeah, so Paul, all Paul really has right now are the Fremen. So, yeah, so I wanted to read this chunk of text, which contains my quote for the week, and it's about the tricks of the Sardaukar. So it goes, in the future, when searching Sardaukar, remember this. So this is referring to the hidden knives in the stillsuit. Remember, too, that each has a false toenail or two that can be combined with other items secreted about their bodies to make an effective transmitter. They'll have more than one false tooth. They carry coils of shiga wire in their hair, so fine you can barely detect it, yet strong enough to garrote a man and cut off his head in the process. With Sardaukar, you must scan them, scope them, both reflex and hard ray, cut off every scrap of body hair, and when you're through, be certain you haven't discovered everything. Yeah, so
funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, the ultimate search, strip and search, right? So I mean, I didn't realize that the Sardaukar were assassins too. This is just
Me
so
too.
You know, this is just so assassin-y, you know, with all this assassin equipment, weapons concealed everywhere. There's always a trick up their sleeve that you least expect. If the Sardaukar are this assassin-like, then I wonder how the Mentats are like, because the Mentats are, you know, the masters of assassins, right?
Right, they're known for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just imagine a Mentat with, you know, double the gear of the Sardaukar, you know. He could literally pull off an arm hair and some poisonous fumes would come out or something. I don't know. You know,
right, and we know Hawat at his old age can take on a Sardaukar too.
Yeah. So it's just really insane to think about that, because the Sardaukar already seem super decked out, right, in our world. And, you know, I just, you know, even though the Sardaukar are characterized as brutes, clearly they've been prepared for something, you know, much bigger than just, you know, fighting in the ranks and fighting in lines. So, I mean, if they're this kind of versatile, they might be a bigger threat than we've expected. And also, you know, for my quote for the week, I like the last sentence of the paragraph, which says, when you're through, be certain you have discovered everything. And as a scientist in training, it's all too true that there's always something hidden outside your grasp that you can discover, even when you've, you know, you've become certain that you've pruned through all of the possibilities. You've searched the entire decision tree, right? And a lot of times I can come back to some problem that I was thinking about for a long time, and I'm like, yeah, I solved this problem, and I'll discover some whole new path. You know, even something as simple as addition, there's so much you can do with it. And and there's a whole new idea that's just right out there and, you know, waiting for me to grab onto. And it's, you know, it's just a testament to staying careful and vigilant too, you know, in something more bigger than science. You know, never be too sure in yourself, because once you become sure, you become lax. And like the Sardaukar car, something will come to stab you in the back if you become too relaxed and you drop your guard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, there definitely are moments where you should be sure in yourself and be confident in what you believe in, because that's when your base comes to shine. And like, if you don't have a solid base that you can rely upon, then you're just going to be like a, you're just going to be a mess when you really need yourself to be confident.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's just also, it's really cool to see how there's just like whole new worlds out there that we don't know about. And once we like, it's a whole, like whenever you discover something new, there's always more and more questions that pop up. Like as a scientist expands further and further into the universe, they start realizing how little they actually know about the universe. It's crazy to think about it. It's just like the realm of knowledge is so vast that like, is it even conquerable for us humans? Like we think we're like all-knowing, but then we discover it's like quantum physics, and that's even crazier than normal physics or something. Like, this is so hard to process. Someone like me can never finish it. I don't know, like it's almost like there might be like one day a cap to how much we could figure out, just because of the learning time it takes for a human to catch up to what has already been discovered, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there definitely are limits to what the human mind can comprehend. So I think that's why, I mean, famous people like Elon Musk are creating things like Neuralink, which will greatly expand our mind capacities. And I heard that some of the features that it can do is give you a photographic memory, allow you to download things straight to your brain. And I guess at that point, our learning curve will just be exponential in the way we learn things.
Maybe so we'll become mentats.
Yeah, we're going to become mentats at that point.
Hopefully. Yeah.
We're going to have to combine our... Yeah, we're going to have to combine our physical capabilities with technology to reach the levels of Paul.
Indeed.
Yeah, Paul's a little way above our pay grade in our lifetime.
Yeah,
I don't think we'll get there. You know, he literally calculating the future. I mean, you know, the data just becomes enormous. Just imagine, you know, 1 millisecond in the future, all the different decision trees that could happen.
Right.
That's something that, you know, I'm a computer scientist, I think, in terms of data. And man, that's a lot of data. Can't process
almost
that.
Infinite.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, for our purposes it's infinite.
Yeah.
Now getting on to my quote of the week, which is the people who can destroy a thing, they control it. So this is in response to the fact that like Paul was asking Gurney like, why do y'all need all this spice? And Gurney was like, because, you know, everyone loves spice. And here Paul's like, well, we actually control it. That means we have the power to, you know, no, we can destroy it. So that means we have the power of controlling it. So Paul is actually so right here, because no matter how much an individual can influence over anything, if another person can simply turn it off or on, you know, it reminds me of how like the Baron kept his subjects in check using like drugs and becoming their supplier for the subjects, you know, like Peter and Hua, he kind of forced them to remain loyal because they were dependent on AKA like the drug or AKA the antidote that only the Baron provides. So Paul right now is actually like turning the tables on the Imperium and on the Harkonnens themselves, unbeknownst to them currently. But this like insane power will become the deciding factor in negotiations further down the line. The real question is where Paul wants it to go, right? Like, what does Paul hope to gain from negotiations? Does he plan to use the Fremen control over the spice to prevent the jihad by drawing a less violent conclusion? Or is he using it only as a stepping stone to accelerate the universal domination that everyone sees in his dreams?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the way I see it, I think he might use it to maybe reinstate House Atreides as a superpower again and turn Arrakis into a paradise. Or he might use it to dominate the Imperium and take them out with the power of spice. But either way, I think it's really smart that he's planning to use spice as the medium or the medium for negotiation. And because it's the most valuable thing in the universe. And I guess it would be like negotiating a trade deal with the US through oil, because
the Saudi princes.
Right. Because he basically offered something they can't do without in order to bend them to his will. And A secondhand effect of this is that he also puts the spacing guild under his thumb because they also heavily rely on spice. Although, I guess that's not really entirely true because they have their own separate deals. So,
but they profit a lot off of the spice trade as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just one of many forms of desert power, the spice. I mean, there's that. I was just Googling it because I remembered something, and there's that quote from the 1984 Doom film. Not the 1984 book, but the film. And it goes, "He who controls the spice controls the universe." So, you know, Paul's using the most powerful leverage here, and he's given the Fremen this place in the universal game that they're playing, right?
Yeah, he's really like bought their way in with the spice.
Yeah, I mean, they were already buying themselves in, but you know, Paul's really doubled down. Yeah, he's gone all in, right?
Uh-huh.
See if he pays out.
Yep. Hope he's gambling. Another thing that we see is that Paul also gambles another part of his life on the fact that he presents the Sardaukar knife that was thrown at him to Stilgar. He literally like puts it right in Stilgar's hand, and he's just like really milking the moment here. The same knife that was thrown at him that failed to kill him, he's offering to Stilgar to give him the chance to kill Paul himself with that own knife. Just like the dramatic irony in this entire situation is insane to me. Like, what a villain Paul is doing such a main character move right now. He's like, kill me if you can.
Yeah, it's honestly such a power move because, I mean, he's really showing Stilgar that he has no plans on killing him and finally making it completely clear. And thankfully, Stilgar seems to understand that. And because we know that Stilgar has been unsure of Paul's intentions, but it looks like he finally got the message after Paul explicitly stated that he would let Stilgar kill him if it came down to it. And is my quote for the week. And it is, if I do, Paul said, I shall stand there without weapon and let you slay me.
Yeah, I mean, this is just one of my favorite moments so far, because it's demonstrating trust between two of these extremely powerful figures. You know, one's more powerful than the other, but they're both very influential. And Paul's given his life up for Stilgar to decide, right? So Stilgar is deciding what to do with Paul. But Stilgar also knows that his life is in Paul's hands too. And the life of the tribe is in both of their hands. And I think Paul's played this really well. He's forcing Stilgar to understand that they need each other to continue making the Fremen stronger. Stilgar at that point was so caught up in the, you know, propriety and the formalities of Fremen culture and all that. But I mean, now, you know, Paul's really just rewriting Fremen culture with every single word he's saying. He's just totally redefining the boundaries of what it means to be Fremen. And doing this in public doesn't hurt too, because now everyone knows what's going on. There's going to be rumors going around. There's going to be people talking about this. And, you know, overall, if a lot of people are agreeing with this decision, then those young men who are rowdy and want Paul to call a Stilgar, they might be a little bit more apprehensive of starting a rebellion.
Yeah, I think like Paul's expert quieting of Stilgar's fears in his provocative confrontation proves that like Stilgar couldn't kill Paul even if he wanted to. Just like such manipulation can only come from understanding the other person at such a deep level. And Paul saw through Stilgar all the way. Like he accurately saw that Stilgar could kill the young man from the tribe on the challenge floor. But the thing is that like Stilgar couldn't kill the Lisan Al-Gayab, who is like the hope and wisdom of the entire Fremen race. With this, he basically lets like Stilgar give it his best shot. You know, he forces Stilgar to have that one chance to kill him. And when Stilgar couldn't do it, it was just like, it's time to let go, Stilgar. You have to drop the old custom of leadership inheritance, and you have to change. You have to like adapt to modern times. He even brings up the fact that Stilgar has, during his time in power, he has broke old customs before by saving Jessica and Paul, you know, all those years ago. So he's changed it once, he could change again, you know, basically same thing.
Yeah, he's got to be fluid, just like water, which they lack.
Bruce Lee, yeah. Just kidding.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that too. But something that Paul does here, which is super smart, is that he changes his title to the Duke of Atreides instead of Muad'Dib to keep the young Fremen from forcing him to call out Stilgar.
Because, oh yeah.
I mean, if he's already the leader of another group, then I guess it would be messy to become the leader of two groups. So in a way, he's sort of separating himself from the Fremen title of Lisan Al-Gaib a little bit.
Yeah, so even though the Atreides are a ghost of their former selves, I'm sure the Fremen have no intention of starting a feud with the Great House, especially if, you know, Paul eventually Well, I mean, he has a descendant now. So if Paul's descendant eventually grows up and rules the planet, you know, the Fremen don't want to be exterminated because of some old blood feud they started. So yeah, I mean, the again, it's just all putting doubt in the minds of those uprising Fremen.
It also provides Paul with greater legitimacy because it just shows that as the Duke of Arrakis, he doesn't have to do things the Fremen way. Like, there's a certain way that a Duke and like the other Imperium houses to handle things, and that means the Fremen can't be telling Paul what to do. They can suggest the fact that he should follow Fremen tradition, but he's no longer under, like, he's no longer like just their leader. He's no longer just under their context. He's got much greater context to cover.
Yeah. And something I want to point out is that the travel plans change. They're no longer going south, but instead to where the war is, which I'm assuming is the Harkonnen strongholds. And I think if they manage to somehow slay Beast Robin, that would throw a wrench in the Baron's plan to make Fade the next leader, which is good for the Atreides.
Yeah, and also Paul decides to leave Shani behind for this expedition to the
Rip
to
Chani.
yeah, I mean, it's just, I mean, I kind of get his decision because,
Me
as Paul
too.
said, Shani's his weak link, right? I mean, he's always going to have to keep an extra eye peeled for Shani, which will distract him from everything else. But it's just, in my opinion, so patronizing. And as you know, again, it's back to this
Yeah.
whole patriarchal. I mean, like, she almost took out Paul on the day they met. You know, Shani had to jump on Paul. If she wanted, she could have just, you know, took his head off, right, or something. I mean,
She just shot
she,
him with the
yeah, I
weapon she
mean,
had.
yeah. So, I mean, she almost took out Paul, and now, you know, she is a hardened Fremen and everything. But why can't she just take care of herself and help Paul at the same time, right? I mean, it's I'm pretty sure Shani's, well, she's not just as strong as Paul, but she's a very strong fighter in her own right. And honestly, it'd be better, in my opinion, if they could figure out how to use each other's strengths and fight as a duo or something, instead of Paul leaving behind such a talented fighter, someone who's pretty crucial to the war effort, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't like how he views Chani as a liability rather than as like
An
someone that could
asset,
help him.
yeah.
Yeah, it's just kind
Yeah.
of sad, honestly.
Yeah, she's a
I'm
key
not sure.
asset, and she has so much experience, and especially as her rank, you know, she was the descendant of Liat Kynes.
And she's also
So,
like an OG, like before the Fated Kin and everything else.
right. So she's always been there, and she's seen her fair share of things. And you know, it would be cool if, you know, they could become a tag team duo, right, somehow. And you know,
Bonnie and Clyde takes over universe.
yeah. So I don't know, but I just feel that Paul leaving Shani behind here isn't the move.
Yeah, it's definitely
But
not the smartest decision, considering, well, I mean, we've known from the start that Chani is very strong, and I feel like she definitely has a role to play in the future, which is maybe what Paul suspects, and that's why he's keeping her from coming. But I think that her role in battle is gonna be far more prominent than just keeping her back. Because I mean, she also needs the experience in fighting in like these actual places. So, and I think in the beginning is probably when it's probably the most dangerous, because it's like when it's their first time. But she really needs that experience in order to become more battle hardened, because she's definitely going to be joining Paul on different expeditions.
The craziest thing is just like Paul, even though he treated Chani this way, he actually is acting differently towards another woman in his life, and that is his mother. He's actually What? Calling for his mother, asking for his mother to come to him. Like,
Whoa.
who knew this day would come? Because for all we knew, like, Paul's been like for so long, like pushing Jessica away, being like, I don't want her. She's influencing me with the jihad. She wants too much out of me. She's like so much tedious training. And we thought for the longest time that Paul had outgrown Jessica, like moved leaps and bounds beyond Jessica and doesn't need her anymore. So like became a young, independent working adult, like a bird flown out of his own nest. But here we kind of see a touching moment. Like we see Paul ask for Jessica to come to him because he still needs her, like her wisdom, her counsel, and handling the fallout of the situation that he created with Stilgar. So it seems that Jessica still does have an integral part to play in Paul's life, even when he is the Fremen leader, because he needs her as the Sayyadina to use her religious justification to wiggle him out of another pickle that the rest of the Fremen society needs him to prove and justify to them.
Yeah, I mean, we all knew Paul is a mama's boy, and I guess it's good to see that some things haven't changed.
Indeed.
Although I suspect the main reason behind his consultation with Jessica is because, I mean, well, she's the only other Bene Gesserit adult that he can consult with, and
I mean, he
I'm
has a
not gonna
sister.
count. Well, I'm not going to count Aaliyah because, well, she's technically not an adult yet.
Right. Yeah, I guess.
I mean, now I guess he also has Gurney, but also Gurney isn't as tuned into everything as Jessica is. So,
yeah.
Though it's like the perfect balance between knowing all their secrets and also knowing everything that's happened. And, you know, right. Gurney only knows, you know, everything about the Atreides up until 3 years ago. He doesn't know anything else, like, of what happened.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of knowing surface level information versus mm-hmm. knowing the actual information.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So we end the chapter on quite the ominous note where Gurney is convinced that Jessica is the traitor. I wonder really? Where he got this information from. A lot. Anyways, he has plans of murdering her for quote unquote betraying the Atreides, but I have a feeling this is not going to turn out well for him. And if you guys want to find out, join us for the next episode next week.
Indeed.
This is why Gurney is not his advisor right now, because he doesn't know anything.
Yeah, and at least, you know, Gurney wants to talk to Paul first before committing assassination on Jessica. So
maybe
Paul will be able to talk some sense or beat some sense into him, whichever way it goes. Yeah, we'll have to find out. And on that note, I believe that concludes the discussion for this episode of the Do Not Enter podcast. Make sure to read the halfway through chapter 44 at having to confront Gurney forced a reassessment of the changes. And tune in next time when we discuss it. As always, thanks to all of you listeners for being patient with us and being interested in our thoughts. Follow us on Instagram at Do Not Enter, Reddit @U/Do Not Enter, Twitter at Do Not Enter, and email us at donotenter@gmail.com. That is donotenter@gmail.com. Please contact us with questions, feedback, or I dare say, I don't know.
What was that word? I think I had amnesia.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I forgot it. Suddenly a word disappeared from my personal vocabulary, so.
I never learned that word.
Yeah. So give us a review on iTunes or Spotify. It only takes a few seconds of your time. So of course you have to go to our show. Well, first you have to make an account and then go to our show and then click the 5-star button because that's the only one that exists. And also leave a nice comment or two if you're so inclined. And it just lets us know that we're doing a good job and also helps us get our podcast out to a wider variety of listeners and helps us climb the charts. So that would be very much appreciated if you took the time to do that. Otherwise, have a great week and we will see you all back very soon.
See you guys.
Bye, guys.